Hi, Newstalk's Ciara Kelly here. Summer always feels like a fresh start, and for a lot of us, that fresh start begins at home. Ideas start bubbling away. Maybe it's a new bathroom, a new kitchen, or a bigger renovation. But this is the moment when it all really starts to take shape. If you're thinking ahead, Tile Style is the place to begin. Tile Style has an incredible range of tiles, flooring, and finishes, and they make the planning side far easier too. Their team can help you visualize your space with customized virtual designs for kitchens and bathrooms so you can feel confident about your choices long before any work begins. And it's a great time to start planning because the Tile Style Summer Sale is now on with 40% off all tiles in stock and incredible reductions on wood flooring, bathrooms and fitted kitchens too. It's a brilliant opportunity to get inspired, make decisions early and take advantage of real savings while you're at it.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. I thank you, as always, for everyone who listens, shares, talks about the podcast. Lovely gentleman on the plane yesterday, he just tapped me on the shoulder and said, I don't want to bother you, but just love the podcast. More of that as well. That's awesome. I was very touched. It's always nice when people stop and say hello. So thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Coming up on this week's program, we're going to be talking about warp drives. So yes, this is Star Trek. And yes, it's a bit nerdy, right? But the mathematics, the underlying mathematics and physics behind warp drives is sound. And on this week's program, we're going to be speaking to an astrophysicist who's trying to figure out the physics and maths to make them a reality. It's Blue Sky Research. I just want to say that, but it's also pretty cool. First, though, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Professor Annie Curtis from RCSI and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen. Shane, our first story has to do with Mars. And I don't know how many times we've played that song. Aidan's a big Bowie fan, our producer, and a big Star Trek fan. So this show is covered with him. But this is a story about potential life on Mars.
Maybe, right? If we discover that life once existed or exists on an alien world, perhaps it'll be the most profound scientific discovery ever. And it seems that we're kind of inching towards this discovery, which is really frustrating from a science communication point of view, but perhaps shows how science really works, which is gradual. And what's happened here is that the Curiosity rover, the car-shaped little truck that's trundling along the surface of Mars, has discovered five molecules in a dried lake bed. And it's thought that they are 3.5 billion years old, which is remarkable that they have survived this long. And they are what's called an organic molecule. So it's a complex molecule that has a lot of carbon in it. And what they're trying to figure out now is, how did it get there? Mm. And might this be the kind of the blueprint or the fingerprint of life that may have once existed on Mars? It can get us so close to an answer, but because Curiosity is kind of only packed with so many scientific instruments, it's not able to tell if these molecules came from a geological process, which is possible, or they came from a meteorite that would have hit Mars. And it's thought that, you know, in that time, that meteorites with organic complex molecules would have been bombarding the Earth and Mars and other places. So we don't know whether it's sort of a precursor or a remnant of something that was once alive, or whether it is just from outer space.
Yeah, because, I mean, the concept of organic life coming to Earth is one of the hypotheses that actually it was brought from comets or other
like
other
water.
Celestial whizzy bits, right?
Yeah.
And so that would very much explain why we have that in Mars. But you talked about, you know, how would it come out of geological reasons? I mean, if life originated in Earth, then it must have only come from geological forces, right? Which I always find crazy that we're walking around and, you know, we're looking at our iPhones and there's, you know, monkeys in the trees and birds in the air. And theoretically, if life didn't come to us, all that came from rocks.
Yeah, absolutely.
Actual inert rocks. That is absolutely bonkers.
And, gas.
And so the two ideas we have is that life came here and life came from rocks. And so either way, that Mars thing is...
it's pretty cool.
It's doable.
Yeah, now they did find a particular molecule, a biomolecule called benzothiophene, which is sulfur containing, and it's known that they tend to come from meteors. But they also found a nitrogen-bearing organic molecule that has a structure that's very similar to DNA.
What?
Yes, but what they're saying here, crucially, is these are the bricks. This does not indicate that they ever got to build a house.
Yeah.
So in other words, and we still don't understand, and Annie will know an awful lot more about this than I do, but we don't understand how we went from chemistry to biochemistry.
Mm.
And that's fundamental, right?
Yeah.
We just don't know. Otherwise, we would be able to synthetically create life.
Mm. Yeah, right, very interesting. Amazing. Very interesting.
Yep.
Annie, our second story is authored by your good self.
Well, me and another PI who's down in Trinity called David Hoey. And I have to give probably credit to the postdoc who worked on this. Her name was Jansu Gorgon, who's now gone back to the University of Genoa and has a position there. So it was kind of a real combinatory effect. So what we were wondering about is bones, right? And how bones heal when they're broken. And this is a big issue because 10% of fractures don't heal. And you can have two types of fractures that don't heal. One is a non-union fracture, which never heals. And then you have a delayed union or delayed fracture, which will heal, but it takes a long time.
But when the fracture doesn't heal, what happens? It could break further, or yeah, it's just constant pain?
Yeah, constant pain, and they have to like bandage it and all of that, right? So we were wondering the role of, I'm a big fan of this immune cell called the macrophage. So macrophage means big and eater, right? So these macrophages, they're really important in terms of bone healing. They come into the site, and there's one type of macrophage. You know, these are very versatile cells, like they kind of can change their function. So one type of macrophage comes in first, it's called the M1, and it just kind of clears up the debris, right? All the kind of mess that was left after the bone was fractured. And then M2 is the second time, which comes in later, and that kind of forms the regenerative response, right? But obviously it's not enough because we have all these fractures that don't heal. And what we figured out is how these macrophages do it is they send out little pockets of information. So these are things like, you know, mRNA that are in there. It's like a little envelope, right, that goes out and kind of signals to other cells. So we figured out that that's one of the reasons that we're working. But the big discovery that we had is that we could create a better macrophage to do this. And how we did it was we kind of tinkered with the cell's metabolism. So metabolism is basically all the reactions that happen within a cell to make it viable. And we tinkered with that metabolism and we were able to create, and I love this, a hybrid macrophage, which is a combination of M1 and M2. And what we found with those macrophages, again, how they signaled was little pockets of information, but we could basically generate more vessels in the bone because you need vessels in the bone to kind of bring, you know, blood and oxygen and whatever. And then also we found that it was better at making bones. So we were able to kind of generate a new macrophage.
How did you do that? I mean, it wasn't like you didn't breed them.
No. So we basically...
a mommy macrophage and a daddy macrophage.
No. What we did was we put in a drug that we knew tinkered with the metabolism. And we had kind of an idea that it might do that just in terms of the chemical reactions that it was going to kind of hit. And that's how we created this. So look, it's still early days. You know, there's a lot more work to be done in the lab before we can see this in kind of a preclinical or clinical concept. But it's probably just the concept of it that making these hybrid macrophages could be really good for bone regeneration.
And that's for any fracture, not for just for the 10%.
Absolutely. For any fracture, yeah, we could use that.
Are you going to be a millionaire? Are we getting investment options for your spin out?
Take a look at this space.
There we go. Shane, our third story has to do with bogus medical claims.
Yeah, so we read all the time that scientists are amongst the most trustworthy profession. The problem is that people also trust other sources of information, right? And this story, which is from Edelman, which is a private company, but it's reported in Nature, says that a staggering number of people believe unproven claims about health and science. From their survey, they said that 2/3 of people, 16,000 of whom were surveyed, believe at least one bogus issue, such as raw milk is healthier than pasteurized milk, or paracetamol when pregnant may cause autism, fluoride is bad for you, childhood vaccines are dodgy, etc. Right? The classics, really.
Raw milk isn't better for you?
No. No, raw milk
there
is.
There you go. We're the two out of three. The perfect thing. 2 out of 3.
Right, there you are. So,
I haven't looked into it.
So people were, and maybe, you know what, you put your finger on it, right? Because whilst the number of people who believe that they're true ranges from 32% of people believe that animal protein is healthier than plant-based protein. That's the highest. And down to 25% of people believe that vaccines are used to control the population. I feel what's more interesting is the number or percentage of people that talk about not knowing, right? And so it's 39% of people said they didn't know whether paracetamol may cause autism in pregnancy for fetuses.
Wow.
And down to 17% of people saying that they weren't sure about the efficacy of vaccines. So maybe what this, I think it's very interesting that we have these statistics that say scientists are trustworthy, yet we know in the real world that that doesn't translate into us all kind of doing things and having policies that reflect that.
Yeah.
So what
there's a major responsibility, I think, from people who have platforms to understand. And it's so easy now for someone to say, this person wants to come on my podcast, this one person wants to come on my radio show, you know, is what they're saying backed up in evidence? You could, I mean, an AI can do that pretty well, you know, and say, look, we don't know, but an AI can actually, you know, vet someone pretty easily and say, this sounds like a bit like it's bollocks.
Do you get bogus people who want to come on the show?
I sent an email today. I'll read it out to you.
All the time.
Very quickly. Given the basis of, I'll redact the name of the doctor. Given the basis of the doctor's unsubstantiated claims, reliance on small, uncontrolled phase one study and the lack of peer-reviewed controlled studies providing any trustworthy evidence that this approach works, we would consider this interview proposal to be irresponsible and dangerous to give it airtime. This is just a small extract from an email I sent just this morning.
I love it. And you're kind of touching on an Associated UK survey that and its idea of responsibility that says now with so much information out there, it's increasingly hard for people to know what's real science and what's pseudoscience.
Yeah. And like this, you know, this particular thing that was pitched to me yesterday would have been a real, like everyone would be tuning into it because it was very, you know, sensational and there would have been lots of clicks. And I, and they've already been on a few radio shows and have a book and so on.
Bones story.
No, it is. I mean, I think there's a role for, you know, science communication. Of course, it's a personal passion of mine, but also, you know, for people to find the right sources and so on. But we've been saying that for quite some time. Annie, our final story has to do with cocaine salmon.
Listen, I love this story, to be honest with you. So it was a story that was, or it was research that was done by this guy called Jack Brand in the Swedish university. And basically what they found out, sorry, is that juvenile Atlantic salmon that were artificially exposed to cocaine or its main breakdown product swam further than the normal fish. So they were more erratic in their swimming, faster. And you might think that's a good thing, but it's actually a bad thing because predators are used to, you know, it can affect predators and it can affect feeding. And also it's changing the biodiversity, you know, within the environment. And it's actually not necessarily cocaine. Like, I was thinking about this. Do you remember when people were looking at levels of COVID in wastewater water and they were able to, you know, determine if there was a lot of infections? Well, this is kind of the same thing. It's not normal water that is showing up in. It's wastewater. And that can, you know, impact the land if there's too much rain or if there's overflows and stuff like that. And then they also found that trout being addicted to methamphetamines also scooted around. They were scooting around, right? Too fast, but I think this is the best. Perch lost their fear of predators due to the fact that they were taking in antidepressants.
So the salmon, how did they get, like salmon don't have like noses to snort. How do they take the cocaine?
They're just ingesting it, just the way they would ingest food and plankton and stuff like that. But
Is this a worry? Is there that much cocaine in the water?
It's the wastewater. Yeah, and there can be a lot of cocaine and there can be a lot of methamphetamines. And what the call is for this is for the pharmaceutical companies to make their medicines greener, you know. And it's actually with the cocaine example, it wasn't cocaine as such. It was a metabolite of cocaine that was doing the danger, right? And so they did a study, like more of a control study, as you're talking about with the email that you had, whereas they basically put kind of a backpack on the fish and one backpack released the coke or the metabolite or the other backpack released nothing.
How do you put a backpack on a
fish?
Well,
I'm just saying backpack.
There are so many questions to this study. And I think we should take the time to answer them.
I'm thinking of sea ledge.
Just out of interest, you know, with the, you know, if predators need to prey on salmon, but you could give a few salmon a bit of coke if they're going to make it all the way into the swimming pools.
Yes,
like, because, you know, there is, you know, it's harder.
Nemo, you know, the way Finding Nemo went over the ledge.
It's harder for salmon to get to where they need to be, the salmon stocks.
But it's
just a little
it's
bit.
Just changing the biodiversity.
Just a bump.
So when they did the study with the backpacks, they could really see that the fish that were that had the cocaine and the metabolite being released were definitely swimming further, you know, a little bit more jittery than the other fish.
Oh, but delayed release. So you give them cocaine first, and then when they get close, just release some, like, marijuana or something. I don't know. I know nothing about this subject. I'm just very interested. An upper, then a downer, to get them there and then slow them back down.
I don't know. It just seems like we're kind of messing with pharmaceutical.
It seems like a crazy study.
It does seem like a crazy study. And I suppose we're not finished with it. I was actually I was on the bike
just stop talking.
I was trying to take
please stop talking
good one.
Is that the best you could do?
You've had this story
for 2 days.
Yeah. Do you know what Jonathan, I'm only cutting.
Oh my god turn off your mic. Professor Annie Curtis, Dr. Shane Bergen, thank you very much. Welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. Now, the cleverer ones of you will know that the closest Earth-like planet to us is Proxima Centauri b, and a lot of people would like to go there and have a look and see what this planet would look like. But the problem is, it would take us 80,000 years to do that. But thankfully, my next guest has a potential workaround, a real-life warp drive. Dr. Katie Clough is an astrophysicist at Queen Mary University of London. She joins me now. Welcome to the program, Katie. Like, this is obviously something that's been in so many science fiction movies and TV series, obviously in Star Trek. But the physics and the ideas behind a warp drive, being able to jump at light speed to another part of the universe, that's kind of what you're working on in a way?
Well, okay, I should caveat a bit before we start and say, you know, most of my work doesn't involve warp drives. I work mainly on black holes. But I have a kind of, side interest in warp drives.
A side hustle.
So I guess, you know, this idea of warp drives, it does have several technical problems in practice, but it is grounded in real physical theory, in particular in Einstein's theory of general relativity, that tells us that space-time can be curved by particular types of matter.
And so how did you end up actually studying something like this, and what drives your interest?
So, I mean, my regular research, as I say, is into black holes, and black holes are where space-time has become so curved that actually nothing can escape from that region. So things just sort of fall into the black hole because it's like a really deep well that they fall into. So describing this kind of curvature of space-time is actually, you know, as I say, it's my day job. It's what I do most of the time. And I use computers to do that. And at some point we realized that all these simulations that we were doing of black holes actually would work for describing this phenomenon of warp bubbles, of warp drives that appear in Star Trek. And since I'm a bit of a Star Trek fan, and a couple of my colleagues who I work with are also big Star Trek fans, we couldn't resist doing some simulations to see what would happen with warp drives if you know, in the hypothetical world in which they existed.
Okay, so talk to me about the physics of a warp drive. You talked about the curvature of space and this idea that time and space are sort of not constant. It's kind of a crazy one. Talk to me about the physics of a warp bubble.
Yeah, so it's really a really radical concept in physics, this idea of space-time curvature. So, you know, if you and I are sitting across from each other in some room, you know, you think that there's a fixed distance between us and that is somehow something that we move through. You know, you could walk across the room to me. But actually what I have in mind with this idea of space-time curvature is that somehow I could shrink the space between us. So we wouldn't get closer because we move through space towards each other. We'd get closer because somehow I compressed space. So space could be kind of squashed into a smaller space. And so by doing that, I arrive next to you, you know, almost instantly, because the space actually has no limit in how fast it can contract. Whereas if I walk across the room, the fastest I can get across the room is at the speed of light, according to our current understanding of physics.
Mm. And so this shrinking of the space in between us, do we see that in black holes? Is that what you mean? Is that theoretically, if we had the immense power to do something like that, and I presume it requires some immense power and some fancy physics, it is theoretically possible.
It is theoretically possible. So actually, you know, objects around us curve space all the time. So they squash it and they stretch it. So things like the Earth and the Sun are actually squashing and stretching space in different directions all the time. So this is a phenomenon that really does happen. Having said that, to do a warp drive, stretching and squashing of space-time is exotic. So it's something that requires a special type of energy. In particular, it actually requires negative energy, which is the kind of practical problem with actually trying to construct a warp drive, you know, in reality, in a lab.
What is negative energy?
Yeah, right. Well, this is a very good question. So in fact, you know, negative energy is something that we don't know that it exists anywhere in our universe. So everything, even antimatter, is actually a positive energy thing. So most of the matter that we know, yeah. So people often think of antimatter; it's everything is negative, but antimatter actually still has a positive energy associated with it. So even that isn't enough. So the only way which we know how to make small quantities of negative energy is through some kind of quantum physics. So quantum experiments can make very small amounts of this negative energy.
Right. So we need a lot of this, though, presumably.
But exactly. So this is the real problem, is that, you know, just a bit isn't enough. And, you know, the quantum experiments tend to make, you know, small amounts. So actually, to construct a warp drive, you need the amount of negative energy is sort of the equivalent of the positive energy of our sun, for example. So it's a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. I mean, and that's a lot of, that's even more negative energy than my poor producer has to deal with. yeah. So just forgetting the impossibility of that right now, because who knows, future technologies and all that.
Right.
Let's imagine that we get that. What is the nature of the warp bubble itself? Could we theoretically enter this and not be squished or crushed or turned into information?
Yeah, so it's a kind of dangerous thing. So you would really want to construct it around you. So in the bubble itself, space is not stretched or squashed at all.
Mm-hmm.
But then you put some matter around you, some of this negative energy matter around you, so that the space around you is stretched and squashed. And you definitely wouldn't want to pass through the bubble wall when it was active, because that would stretch and squash you as it stretches and squashes space. So you would definitely, you know, find that, you know, a bad experience.
That'd be unpleasant. Yeah, it sounds very unpleasant. And so there's a way of sort of creating this around you in theory. Then how do you, once you've created the bubble, though, how do you go about collapsing space and time so that you can move through through space?
So actually just constructing the bubble is enough. So if the bubble is constructed correctly, it will automatically start to compress the space in front of you and stretch the space behind. And in this way, you kind of surf through the space-time on this wave of curvature.
Wow.
So you sitting in the bubble, you don't really feel anything. You still just feel like you're sitting in space. So it's not like being in a rocket where you'd be kind of pressed against the back wall as it drives through space. It's really something that doesn't rely on the kind of normal momentum, exchange of momentum of expelling some fuel that we normally use to power a rocket.
It's chill, essentially.
It's a very chill way to travel through space.
Okay. And so how long would it take then if we managed to create this warp bubble, how long would it take to get to Proxima Centauri B?
So, yeah, in principle, the warp drive, because, as I say, you're not actually traveling faster than the speed of light locally, you're actually just making space get smaller. You can travel in principle faster than the speed of light. So you could get there almost instantly. I have to say, you know, this is theoretical. and we kind of believe that there should be reasons why you can't do that. We think that there should be something that breaks down when you start to travel faster than the speed of light, that maybe some kind of, you know, quantum instability kicks in and, you know, it prevents you from actually crossing that kind of barrier and traveling faster than the speed of light.
I'd imagine it is currently very difficult to research anything that travels faster than the speed of light.
It is pretty hard, yeah.
Okay, so we're talking about theoretical physics in many respects, but at the same time, theoretical physics, like Einstein proposed nearly 100 years ago, gave us black holes, you know, the ideas behind black holes. And so if we think about that, and then we think about, well, you know, if we built the technology, some other civilizations may have built the technology before us. Is it possible to, if someone's snapping space out there, is there any chance we might be able to see it on our telescopes?
Well, so this was exactly the question that we asked ourselves when we did these simulations. We thought about the case where, you know, as you say, maybe we haven't got the technology to build a warp bubble, but maybe someone else out there in the galaxy has. And so what we can do is we can simulate these warp bubbles, and in particular simulate when they kind of turn off, when they collapse. And that generates gravitational waves. So because space and time is stretchy and being stretched and squashed, when you turn the warp drive off, when it collapses, it actually creates ripples that travel through space and time.
For sure.
And they would reach us here on Earth. And we, quite excitingly, we have the technology to detect those gravitational waves. So we've had for the past 10 years the ability to see gravitational waves coming from black holes merging with each other. The question was, you know, could we use those same detectors to see ripples from alien spaceships?
Mm. And the answer is...
And the answer is, well, unfortunately, probably not.
Oh.
But actually, for an interesting reason. So although actually the signals would be quite loud, they would be at the wrong frequency. So if you have so we assumed that our spaceship was about a kilometer big, which is consistent with Star Trek. In Star Trek, and the Enterprise E is a kilometer across. So, you know,
You're deep in there, Katie. You're deep in there.
I know. We had a lot of fun with the project, I have to say.
Oh, look, in fairness, you have to pick a certain size. Why not pay homage? Yeah.
It's a reasonable size. So we are assuming that, you know, our aliens are kind of human-sized and they might be smaller or bigger. But, you know, if it's a kilometer across... the kind of frequency of the gravitational waves that we would receive would be much higher than where the current detectors are looking.
Mm.
So actually the strength of them is sufficient that current detectors could detect them if they were in the right frequency regime, but current detectors are focused on lower frequencies that are consistent with black holes. So if you can persuade someone to build a detector at a higher frequency, in principle, you know, if someone was flying around the galaxy in these warp drives, potentially the signals could be detectable there.
Yeah, very difficult, I would imagine, to convince the scientific community at large if you did detect these that was what's happening. I would imagine.
I think a little bit
more evidence would be required. But you talked about sort of turning off the warp drive. I'm thinking of like the negative pressure and the positive pressure of like deep, you know, deep underwater, and like just, you know, then just stepping out of that, you would instantly be squished. Like, is it possible to just turn off a warp drive and remain intact physically?
Well, yeah, this was one of the other things that we found, is that, you know, this turn off is a violent process. So actually what we ended up saying in our article is really, this is the scenario that you often get in Star Trek, where there's a collapse of the warp drive containment field.
Right.
So, you know, the warp drive suddenly stops working and you know, your warp bubble is going to collapse. And, you know, this happens, as I say, in Star Trek quite a lot. So they always panic when it happens, and they panic for a very good reason. And that's because all of this stretching and squashing of space-time around you tends to collapse inwards. And it means that you would basically be kind of ripped apart by all the tidal forces of space stretching. So it's a very bad thing for the Enterprise if this does happen.
Right, but even if you were to try and control the turning off of the warp drive and it didn't collapse, is it possible theoretically to, I guess, neutralize the massive compression of space and time around you to, you know, to basically exist on Proxima Centauri and walk on the surface?
You know, in principle, if you really could control with great precision how space curves, you could make it so that it doesn't just collapse inwards onto you, that it kind of disperses in a controlled way. Mm. You know, it's a very advanced technology that I would have no idea how to even begin constructing. But yeah, you know, if we're imagining that aliens have constructed this thing in the first place, why not imagine that they have the technology to control it really precisely and turn it off in a controlled way, rather than what we did, which was, you know, in some ways just an accidental collapse.
Very good. In terms of the maths behind this, what bits are missing from it? Like what you know, if you look at this, what bits are missing for figuring out just on paper whether or not we could build something like this?
Yeah, so as I say, actually, the mathematics of general relativity describe quite well this warp drive. So the real barrier is this construction of negative energy density in large quantities.
But we know that negative energy density would actually invoke this curving of space.
Yeah, right. So the problem is a kind of, you know, an engineering one of creating this negative energy density and then controlling it sufficiently to get it around us into a bubble. And as we discussed, you know, turning it off in a controlled way. But, you know, we understand quite well the mathematics of, you know, if we were able to somehow physically do that, how the curvature of space-time would change and how it would move us through space. We're able to describe that using the mathematics of general relativity.
And I mean, from a purely curious scientific inquiry point of view, it is probably useful in a couple of different ways to be thinking about this, right? There are probably reasons why this is good to think about.
I like to think so. So, I mean, you know, another motivation for doing this is understanding these exotic types of matter is related to trying to understand questions about the early universe, or in particular the Big Bang. If we came from a singularity, you know, singularity just means we don't really understand the physics of what's happening there. And a lot of the resolutions of these singularities that occur in the Big Bang and also in the center of black holes involve some kind of negative energy density or some kind of exotic matter that would come in at very high energies that we experience in these kind of situations.
I'm trying to think of what the Star Trek sign-off is now. Peace, live long and prosper. Is that it?
Live long and prosper.
Katie Clough, astrophysicist at Queen Mary University of London. Thank you so much for joining us. Live long and prosper.
Thank you very much.
That's it for this week's episode. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey producing, Rory Galvin on podcast, and Hugo da Silva Scott on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.